Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, I talk with Anika Larsson. Peter and Michael join in to review the Atlantic Theatre Company's production of Posterity and Broadway by the Year, the Broadway musicals of 1941 to 1965 at the Town Hall. In the news, we talk about why Honeymoon in Vegas is closing, and it looks like Hunchback of Notre Dame won't make it across the river. Audra takes to Twitter, Cats has a fall 2016 revival, Al Pacino comes to Broadway in China Doll, and Tommy Toon's 10th Tony. Please stay tuned.
If you ever find yourself lost in the dark and you can't see, I'll be the light to guide you. Find out what we're made of when we are called to help our friends in need. You can count on.
And welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, April 5th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His new one is The Great Parade, which was released. No, it will be released in 2 days, Peter Willen.
Well, I'm told it's already at Barnes & Noble, so I guess they're ahead of the game there. But anyway, it won't be long before it's available at the very least.
Excellent. Peter can be read at MTI Critcherland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears to Talk in Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com, as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So one thing I wanted to mention and talk with about briefly with the listeners is that at the very end of the podcast, we talk about various different ways you can listen to us. And I know that a lot of people tune out at the very end. It happens in all podcasts. So I would love it if... now you're listening to this, if you would stop by iTunes and give us a good rating, because good ratings at iTunes will help us be lifted in the rankings there. And although we are very high in the Broadway rankings at iTunes already, it's nice to be number one. So if you do...
It's good to be the king.
It's good to be the king. So thank you very much. And so I would love it if you could just pause the podcast for a second, run over to iTunes, give us a good rating, and let's get us out there and spread us wider and farther. With us today, we have a returning guest. And we normally don't have returning guests, but 2 weeks in a row, returning guests. Anika Larsson is with us, and we last spoke to Anika back... May 18th of 2014, so less than a year ago. And Anika, we want to welcome you back to Broadway Radio. And
thank you. I'm flattered to be a return guest. I didn't know that was so rare. This is very exciting.
Very rare. And, shockingly...
Worth it.
Shockingly, we had a return guest. We don't have, we've probably only had two or three return guests in the last five, 6 years.
Wow.
And last week, our return guest was some chick named Jessie Mueller.
Never heard of her.
Never heard of her. You know, wannabe. Just a wannabe.
Yeah.
So,
I miss her. We're texting. We have a group text going, Jessie and Jared Spector and me, going, because we just miss each other so much, because Jessie and I left the show on the same day. And so we don't have anything really to talk about, but it's just the sort of, I miss seeing you eight times a week kind of texts.
Yeah. So. Absolutely. Yeah. So May 18th, 2014, we spoke, and it's less than 365 days.
Yeah.
What has happened in those days since?
A few things. A few things have happened in my life. I recorded an album, which was entirely unexpected and something I never thought I'd pursue. I moved out to the suburbs from my apartment I lived in Brooklyn for 13 years to be with the man I love. He got me pregnant and we got married. And I had my debut at Birdland with an album release concert for this album, Sing You to Sleep, which I imagine we'll talk about. let's see. I don't know what else. There's, I feel like that's enough. And yet,
I'm exhausted. Just listen to it. You know?
Yeah, it's been a whirlwind of a year, man.
Well, congratulations on so many different fronts.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You know, I hear that Sing You to Sleep was something, and maybe you can confirm this or deny this, Sing You to Sleep was something that you kept on saying no, 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 and the producer had to convince you to make it.
Yeah, I really didn't ever think about being recording an album. I think I have a good sense of my skills and talents and of my voice. So I'm not being coy or looking for compliments when I say I just don't think I have the kind of voice that I personally would want to listen. This is a terrible way to sell the album. I would just want to listen to just sing. I think that what I do is I sing and I act together. And so that is what makes me good at what I do, and part of the way I've earned my way into the cream of the crop in New York City. So there are people out there whose just like voice qualities I think are more interesting and gorgeous to listen to. I always am really envious of people with like a raspy, cool quality to their voice. And I just feel like what I do is sort of like I can do some sort of vocal pyrotechnics and stuff, but mostly what I can do hopefully is sell a song either by acting it in a way that moves you or by making you laugh while I sing it. And that's what makes me compelling. And so the idea of just singing, especially because I don't write. So it wasn't like I was going to, like I wanted to record an album to share my music with people. The idea of just me singing other people's music felt self-indulgent in a way that I was like deeply uncomfortable with. I think a lot because I'm mildly neurotic because I'm one of 10 kids. And so all growing up, this childhood has made me a person who is like desperately craves attention. And then, but if I get more than what feels like my fair share of it, I start to get really uncomfortable. So a show like Beautiful is perfect for me because I'm really nicely featured. And so I get the attention I crave, but then it's such a strong, gorgeous ensemble that that's what feels right to me as being one of the larger group, which is so how my identity was formed. So this idea of an album of literally just me singing felt just super uneasy to me. So I said no. And I said, thank you very much, but no. And in my mind was saying heck to the no, but I kept it kinder because Dan Watt is such a lovely person. And then I would say a few weeks after he asked me, I was singing lullabies with my nieces and nephews. Actually, not even at night. We were sitting on a trampoline in my sister's backyard, and we were just singing the songs that I've sung to them for years. And I thought, wait a minute, an album of lullabies I could get behind because that has a purpose that is larger than just listen to me sing, please. And also, you know, everybody needs a baby shower gift or a kid's birthday gift every once in a while. So there's a reason to buy it other than just trying to support me. So I actually thought it might even make it more marketable for Dan Watt, and, you know, instead of just, I was sort of like, there's going to be like 50 Broadway obsessed people and my mom who would buy just a regular album. But this might actually reach a broader audience. So, but I do feel very strongly that I don't like the idea of dumbing down music for children, because you know, my baby's listening to Stevie Wonder in utero right now, and to my baby's daddy, who's a jazz trumpet player, so he plays for the baby. I think that kids can handle a sophisticated musical sound, and I think you should play for them what you want them to love. So when I went to meet with Michael Kreuter, who's the head of Yellow Sound Label, and David Cook, who was my MD on the project, who I just think the world of. His arrangements are so fantastic. But he's Taylor Swift's MD. I don't know if you've heard of her. I had never heard of her. Just kidding. but he's fantastic. And so when I went to meet with them, I said, I really want this to be more Norah Jones than The Wiggles. I don't want it to feel like a kid's album. Also because just I don't want to rule out the people who do love Broadway and might want to buy an album from somebody who works on Broadway. And also because I think adults need lulling too sometimes. I know I sure do. So we all could use a little music to sort of ease us at the end of a long day or anytime we need a little soothing. So they totally got it, totally ran with it. And I just couldn't be prouder of this product.
So Dan Watt is the executive producer who talked you into it.
Yes.
And then you also mentioned your musical director. You know, this list of songs that I pulled together, I was playing it in the house, and the kids were singing along because they have stuff from Bruno Mars.
Yeah.
And you have stuff from James Taylor and the Gershwins. And yeah. I mean, you know, it's an eclectic pull together, but it all works together. So who came up with this song list in the end? How did you pull it all together? And was there stuff that, you know, you are limited to a certain number of minutes, that stuff that you had to cut that you really liked?
Yeah. You know, Dan and Michael and David Cook, they were all really lovely about really letting me steer this thing. And so I put the song list together. I mean, most of them are songs that I really did and have sung to kids for years. Nannying and babysitting have always been my day job. Even since I was 13, I've been taking care of kids and singing to kids. So I had built a sort of a repertoire, and actually very few of them are actually technically lullabies, partly because I didn't know as that many lullabies, and partly because it was always more fun to sing songs that I just thought were pretty. I just thought if it's slow and it's pretty, then I'll sing it. And if it has nice imagery that you'd want to fall asleep thinking about. So I sort of racked my brains to think of all of the songs that I had sung to kids. And then in terms of picking the winner, because that was like 25 songs, and so sort of shaving it down to the ones that are on the album, I wanted there to be, like you noted, a sort of eclectic mix of different kinds of sounds. Of my 9 brothers and sisters, 6 are adopted from different races and countries. And so we're this sort of rainbow-colored family, and multiculturalism has really been important in my life. And so I wanted there to be different kinds of sources for the songs on the album. So that helped in terms of shaping it. And in terms of creating a sort of cohesive sound, it definitely was David Cook did just an extraordinary job in the arrangements. And I think I did, you know, in sort of naming Nora Jones or Diana Krall as inspirations, it definitely has sort of a jazzy feel. So every song has a little bit of a jazzy feel, and the band plays jazz really nicely. And my Freddie, my husband, and baby daddy, he plays trumpet on it on a few songs. So it wasn't actually that hard. Dan Watt asked me, he very smartly just started, he said, make your list and then pick the 5 that you absolutely have to have on the album. And then he said, now pick another 5 that you absolutely have to have on the album. And so that was when it became the question of like, which ones absolutely cannot be missed. That was easier than just the sort of general question of what songs are great that I would love to do. So, but there definitely was, you know, writers always talk about killing your darlings when they're writing plays or TV or books, just stuff they have to cut that they love, but that just doesn't ultimately serve the greater purpose in the right way. And I think that the toughest song to cut was, like I said, Stevie Wonder. I just is one of my favorite artists of all time, and one that I want my kids to grow up knowing. And so I thought for sure I'd have a Stevie Wonder song on the album. Most likely Knocks Me Off My Feet, but it just didn't end up making the cut. And so that was probably the hardest one, but for the most part, it was really pretty easy to put the list together.
So you also have, on track number 6, You Can Close Your Eyes, from James Taylor. Some hack sang with you.
Yes. Well, that was the young lady you mentioned earlier, Jessie Mueller. She came in and did, that's one of the songs that I didn't really know of until recently, and never really did sing to children. But I wanted to, because all of this came about because Dan saw me in Beautiful, I wanted to sort of pay homage to the show in the album. So I wanted there to be a song written by my character Cynthia Weil and her husband Barry Mann, which is Somewhere Out There, which is on the album. And then I also really, really fell in love with You Can Close Your Eyes because when we were all doing research about 1.5, 2 years ago, I happened to see on PBS Carole King and James Taylor live at the Troubadour.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Which I actually now apparently saw on like every week. So you can imagine. I thought it was this extraordinary thing that it happened, like so serendipitous, but it's almost on nightly. They love Carole King and James Taylor over at PBS. And rightly so. And so that song, You Can Close Your Eyes, they sang as a duet. And it was just so stunning that I immediately downloaded it and listened to it sort of obsessively for months. And it's just one of the prettiest songs I've ever heard. And so I knew for sure I wanted it on the album. And I loved the idea of bringing a guest singer in to sing with me. And I thought, well, who better to sing the Carole King part than fake Broadway Jesse Mueller Carole King? So I asked her, and she said yes, because I'm so lucky, and it sounds just gorgeous. It's, I think, my favorite song to listen to on the album. I just love the way we sound together. I just love singing with her.
So on the group text with you and Jared Spector and Jesse, is Jared like, hey, no song for me?
You know, actually, it occurred to me, well, because when we did the Birdland album release party, I had him come sing Somewhere Out There with me, because he plays Barry Mann, so it was only appropriate. And then I was like, why didn't I just have him sing it with me on the album? Like, it never actually occurred to me, which feels like an idiotic move, and it's too late now. But I do in looking back, think that I like something about there only being female voices on the album. Jesse, me, and my friend Kenita Miller, who I did Xanadu with years ago. She's the backup singer on the album. And there's something about that that I like. So I'm okay with it as a final choice. But it's funny to me that it didn't even occur to me, because it's written as a duet. It was James Ingram and Linda Ronstadt. So it was originally a duet. And then I made it a solo, which just felt sort of silly. But I really do like that arrangement. It's sort of a samba. It's kind of awesome. So I'm happy with the way that turned out as well. And my Freddie plays flugelhorn on that. So it's fun too.
Next album, you can do it with just a bunch of men, because you can get Jared to do it with you. And your buddy who calls you Boston Cream Pie.
Joshua Henry, yes. I call him Key Lime Pie because he's from Miami. But people keep saying, it makes stresses me out a little bit when people are like, her debut album. And I'm like, that implies that I have to do another one. Enough? Honestly, seriously. I mean, I'm not being coy. I just really think this is plenty. I didn't even intend to do this one. So I don't know that I need to do another, but I will keep that in mind. I think better than me doing another album and including those men is if they do albums, because I would buy their albums, and then they ask me to come guest sing on one song on their album. Then I feel like that's really everybody wins.
That is a similar strategy to the best boat you can buy is, have your friend have a boat.
Exactly.
And you just use it,
Who wants to take care of a boat?
Exactly. Who wants to do that? Okay. So, you have, some big events coming up in your life.
I do. I do indeed. One major one. We were just at childbirth prep yesterday. And so end of June, this thing is coming out of me by hook or by crook. So there's no going back now. I'm 7 months pregnant this week, so.
Well, what are you, do you have any post plans? Are you looking to get back into the swing of things? Did you officially leave the show, or are you just on maternity leave?
I'm just on maternity leave. I have about 6 months left on my contract once I go back. So, the lovely thing is I can pretty much decide when I want to go back. I just have to give them a month's notice, but I know it'll be in the fall sometime. Until then, this is our first baby, so we'll be figuring out how to be parents. What's really fortunate is Freddie gigs out at night, but he also teaches middle school band up here in Rockland County. The baby's due June 23rd, which is his last week of school. So, we will have the whole summer where we have no plans, where we can just be, figuring this whole parenting thing out.
If you figure it out, please let me know.
I will absolutely email you the secret.
Because,
I'm sure it will be 25 words or less. You'll see it and you'll slap your forehead and think, thank God, Anika sent me this email.
I am just about to have a teenager, and
yikes!
One of us is going to die.
So, yeah.
No. So Rockland, are you in this Broadway Rockland mafia? The Neil Berg crowd.
I love Neil Berg, and yes, he is up in Nyack. I do know that. although we haven't talked yet about the fact that we're both in Rockland County, I'm so new up here. My friend Maya Days lives around the corner from me. She and I did rent together in '97 out in LA. We were in the LA company, and so I've known her for many, many years. And when I first started dating Freddie, I remembered New City. I thought I think. Maya lives up there, and so I texted her, and she said, "Yeah, absolutely." And it turns out she literally lives around the corner from me.
Yeah.
So she's the only person I know out in this city. but it's great. She's actually coming over later today. I told her I had to do this interview first, and then she's going to come on over and see our new bathroom.
Oh, well, you can go down to the Palisades Mall and hang out there too. You know,
I have been. I'm not sure malls are really my thing, but
gives you something to do. Did you know that Broadway World was begun in Rockland County?
I did not know that.
Yeah, Rob Diamond used to live in Rockland County, and he and I got together before Broadway World started, and actually had meetings in his apartment about creating the site. So,
yeah. Wow. Yeah. Cool, because you're doing it, apparently. I like it.
Yeah. So your husband is a middle school teacher and a trumpet player. And how did you guys get together?
That is also because of Beautiful. Beautiful has brought a lot of beautiful things into my life. My dresser, one of my dressers at the show at Beautiful, set me up on a blind date with him. And it was the best blind date of my life. It was last February. And things happened really pretty quickly. Neither of us were spring chickens. And so we both were old enough to have been out there and see what's out there and know when we got a good thing and snatch it. So by summer, I was living out here with him. By fall, I was pregnant. And then in this past February, on our year anniversary, we went to the town clerk's office and got hitched. So it's been pretty blissful. He's really, really, really wonderful. And we both tell each other how lucky we are every day. It's really kind of gross around here, actually. It's the sweet, saccharine nature of our relationship. I think it's got to fade at some point, but for right now, it's pretty disgusting. I'm glad nobody else is in the house with us most of the time.
Oh, and did you bring half of Boston down to celebrate, or did you guys go up there
For the wedding?
Just to, you know, if you...
We really, it was basically, we sort of eloped. We thought...
Yeah, that's what I...
Yeah, pretty last minute. And so we're actually going to have a real ceremony in October.
Oh.
Actually, in Maya Days' backyard, because she's got a gorgeous backyard with a stream flowing through it and a bridge over it. And so she's hosting us for our wedding. So we'll have a real wedding. And yes, everyone from Boston will come down. But for this one, no, we didn't tell anybody. And then we called everybody after. And that was fun. Because they were all pretty happy for me. Because I think we were all at some point about to give up hope on my love life, you know. So everyone in my family is pretty excited.
That's pretty funny. All right. Well, I will remind our listeners that you can check out Anika's new album, Sing You to Sleep, at the Yellow Sign label. I'll have a link to that in the show notes. And thank you so much for coming back and chatting with us about it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll speak to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. You'll spread your wings and you'll take to the sky. But till that morning, there's nothing can harm you. With Mama and Daddy
. So we took a little bit of a break from our Broadway shows. We certainly have, 5,000 new shows opening in the next 3 weeks. But Peter and Michael took a break from Broadway this week, and Peter went to see Posterity at the Atlantic. So Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. This is Doug Wright's new play. And Doug, of course, became famous for I Am My Own Wife, which won a Tony some years ago. He's dealing with far more famous characters here. One of them is Henrik Ibsen, the Norwegian playwright who is still getting produced today, needless to say. So here's a man who is very imperious, knows he's great, knows he's done a good job writing plays. And because of this, his agent thinks that he should be immortalized in stone, sculpted. So there's a reasonably famous sculptor involved here, too, though we may not have heard of him, Gustav Vigeland. At the time, he was considered Norway's most amazing sculptor. And in fact, the Nobel Prize Peace Medal was something he designed. So here we are. We have two big characters. That sounds good, doesn't it? And the thing is that Ibsen does not want to sit and have his bust made because he just feels it's beneath him. He doesn't think that he should be in the park where pigeons are going to defecate on him. I was a little sorry to hear that concept because that seems like such an obvious one. But anyway, in the meantime, while the sculptor is a very famous man and is doing good work, he needs the money. Who doesn't? You know, I mean, so that's a conflict as well. So while he gets on his high horse and tries to pretend that he has no interest in doing this, he really does. So the first act has a lot of push-me-pull-you there with I'm not going to do it, you are going to do it, you should do it, you have to do it, all that stuff. And that's very entertaining. However, there are three other characters in the show: the agent, a cleaning woman, and an apprentice sculptor. And I have to say that whenever they're on stage, it isn't nearly as interesting because they're not nearly as interesting and they're not as grand people. I fully expected at the end of the first act, when we didn't know what was going to happen, if indeed Ibsen was going to sit for the – of course, we knew he would because there'd be no play if he didn't. I fully expected the second act to begin with him sitting there and giving in and whatever banter they would go on about the value of art. The commercialism that comes into play with art, how you're received in art, all that stuff. I thought that was going to come out. There is so much talk between the cleaning woman and the apprentice, or the apprentice and the agent, so on and so forth. It's just not as compelling. When you have two great characters, let's hear from them all the time. That's what we want to hear from. And it's just not compelling. Well, what is compelling, however, they certainly got the right man to play Ibsen, because John Noble truly looks like every picture you've ever seen of Ibsen. And thank God it's not just a case that he looks good. He really has that imperious nature that's needed for the character. Hamish Linklater, an actor I always enjoy seeing, plays the sculptor, and he does a wonderful job as well. And Dale Soulais plays the cleaning woman very well. So I am not quarreling with the performances here, even though I don't get terribly interested in the characters. But Dale Soulais, who many of us may remember 40 years ago from The Magic Show, singing West End Avenue and The Lion Tamer, two songs that were reasonably popular at the time, here she is, still working and playing the cleaning lady. And the poor soul has to be nude, too, by the way, because we're talking about a sculptor. She's his model occasionally. There's a little twist and funny business that goes on with that, too. A little surprise that happens right at the top of the show. So this is one of those, you know, in Lennon Maltin's book, you see anywhere from bomb to 4 stars, and so many movies get 2.5 stars. That's what this would get if we were working on a star principle.
Peter, that is the first time I have ever heard that pronunciation. Is that something you've learned recently, that it's Dale Soulais?
Oh, I always assumed it was.
Oh, okay. I when we spoke about her in Hands on a Hard Body, I thought we both said souls, but maybe it was just me.
I have no idea. I've been saying that for 40 years, but I have no idea.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, check that out.
All right. So, unfortunately, today is closing day. It's played from February 25th through the April 5th, which is when we're recording. So if you're listening to this and you haven't seen it, you've missed it. But the Atlantic Theater Company, always doing great work. They have lots of stuff going on all the time. They have next thing up for them, they have something called Camp Capawana. Capuana. Guards at the Taj. They have a full series there. We'll have a link to their website from our show page. Next up, Michael got to see...
I was just going to say something else is closing today, isn't it?
What?
Oh.
Vegas.
Oh, Honeymoon in Vegas. That's right. Yeah. And that was a quick notice, wasn't it? I think that I first read about it Monday night or Tuesday morning or something like that, that it was closing.
Yes.
And I'm very sad about that. And is closing, you know, before the awards season. It's hard to really rack up any awards when you're not open. In my opinion.
It's going to cost them, no question. But it has cost them, literally. So as a result, how much more money can you lose just on the off chance you're going to get nominations?
And we talked about this before about the wisdom in opening it when they did a few months ago, and how long the discussion was that the producers seemed to have planned for this and had enough money to keep it running, but the best laid plans of mice and men didn't come to fruition here.
Well, it's funny. Last year at the Theater World Awards, Rob McClure performed his opening number of Honeymoon in Vegas, and I said, "What's happening?" He says, "We're going to open in the spring," you know, and then suddenly that didn't happen. They wanted to bring it in earlier, but one has to wonder if they would have been better off opening in the spring, and maybe not, since we have so many musicals that are happening, but. Obviously, what they did not work. So it's really too bad that it worked out that way. I'm sorry, too, because I do believe they deserve nominations. And I agree with James that they're going to be denied them simply because they're not here. And so many other shows are. And, you give to those that can profit from it, whether we like it or not. But I'm rooting for Rob McClure to get a nomination and plenty of others in the show, too. I know that's now quite the dark horse.
Well, I guess we should all keep in mind there are so many variables as to when a show opens and where it opens. I'm pretty sure that I have heard that this was not their choice of theater.
Yeah.
And even if nothing else but that had been different, that might have made enough difference to give it more foot traffic and just be people be more aware of it if it was more in the right in the heart of the, you know, those 44, 45, 46 street corridors. You'll never know about these things because you can't go back in time and redo them.
Going back in time, though, if this were 1995, I would have to agree. But given the fact that we've had two shows run over 1,000 performances and one of them substantially more, obviously Rent is what I'm talking about, and Newsies even, I mean, people found those theaters, with those shows. So, it's just harder to pin it on the theater this time than it would have been. Yes, that was a Jinx house for years and years and years. Didn't have a hit for the longest time. I think maybe their last hit before Rent was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in 1962. Mm. There may have been another one in between, but nothing much. You might say, Betrayal made money. A hit. The thing is that we can't argue as much about that as we used to, about the place where it is. There was more to it than that, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And I personally think that's a great location because aside from everything else, you can get to and from it without running the gauntlet of Times Square. And this is not that's not a small thing. But I don't know. I people have discussed this and they said, yes, but Rent was, it was kind of thought of as a separate animal, almost like this very new type of musical coming from the public. And it had a different audience from the beginning that maybe was then built upon. But initially it was those really hardcore, new agey sort of kind of people. And then Newsies, I guess they really developed a rabid fan base quite soon because I had a friend in it and, he would tell stories and post photos and things like that. Whereas Honeymoon is a much more traditional middle of the road show. So that's why I say that perhaps it would have at least helped somewhat if they had been. I don't mean to imply that. Because it's floppy. Because I think much more of an issue was the many things, but the very, very long preview period, because the show doesn't get as much awareness, even in the internet age, during previews as it does when it opens. Opening of a show is always that's not till that point that a lot of people say, oh, there's this show I can go see.
Right. It's here. Right.
It's really too bad, but I enjoyed it very much. I didn't think it was perfect. I don't think Peter thinks it was perfect either, but it had many great things in it, an excellent score, wonderful performances.
It also had high ticket prices. I don't mean higher than anybody else's, but I do believe that's a factor as well. I think there is a part of the public now that says, really, we are not going anymore. I think that's what's hurting them too. It's really a shame that things have to be so high, especially with premium seats and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's frightening. And I think the public is really starting to perceive, I could be wrong about this, I think the public is really starting to perceive that premium prices are the norm, because they hear about them so much. You know, the things I read about, you know, people, like Fish in the Dark, for example, you know, and all that kind of stuff. I think they're starting to think it really costs that much money to go to a Broadway show, and that's really regrettable. So
and really dangerous to the
audience. Dangerous as well, indeed.
It's funny what you're saying there, because first let's put the caveat out there that I think I've mentioned this before, that I have no objectivity, when it comes to Jason Robert Brown shows. I'm such a big fan of Jason Robert Brown. I was a huge fan of all of his work, and that so I can't understand why people don't like his haven't been taken to his show in a commercial sense. But I think that there's a failure of marketing here, because what you're talking about is that the message is not getting through to the general public that they can see a good show at a reasonable price, mm-hmm. and that the premium seat has become the norm, and people perceive that they can't afford it. But they're going to see other stuff. And that when I see shows like Mamma Mia running for years and years on end, we know that, selling tickets is not about quality. Mm-hmm. it's about marketing. And Broadway is about marketing. And I don't think that they've done a good job of getting the message out for Honeymoon in Vegas. And just same thing as Bridges in Madison County. I said that at the time when Bridges closed, that it was a failure of marketing. And I think Honeymoon's a failure of marketing. And I'm afraid that how many more times can we do this before, A, Jason gets discouraged and doesn't bring anything to Broadway?
Absolutely.
And how long before an investor says, I can't really back the Jason Robert Brown show?
Right.
You know what just popped into my head? What do you think of this? One solution you would think might be to give a considerable discount for tickets bought in advance. But the problem with that is that we are now told that people do that much less often than they used to. I believe the perception is that ever since 9/11, people's attitude changed, and they just don't want to plan that far ahead.
Can I talk about that for a second?
Yes, please.
People pin this on 9/11, and you know what happened right around 9/11 is that the internet exploded, and that you can buy tickets online. I think that it was not so much a 9/11 change as much as in the ability to get tickets much easier and scope things out. But that's an interesting thing that you're saying about tickets. And Ken Davenport has talked about this for many, many years. I think that one of the things is that people perceive that I don't need to purchase the tickets in advance because I can get day of tickets for a discount. And I think that in one respect, TKTS has done a big disservice to Broadway.
Oh, I agree entirely. TKTS was a good deal for the first 2 years. But the thing is, prices went up like crazy as a result of that booth. I'm afraid it is a big problem. So But Michael, essentially what you're saying is, I guess, analogous to low price previews, you know, I mean, which used to happen, and those disappeared. If you're buying, the public is used to that concept, by the way, because how many times have you seen, you know, if you buy a ticket to a dance, you know, it's $5 now and $10 at the door. Right. You know, I mean, I think the public does understand that point of view. But ironically enough, it's a variation on low price previews when you think of it.
Well, it's a different way. But
it is.
You know. The thing is that to me, that would be – there are so many ways that they discount tickets now, but we can't necessarily be expected that the general public knows about them. I think don't you think that's the big issue? So as you said, Peter, there are all of these people who – think it costs $450 to see a Broadway show, and because they're not aware of the 25, Broadway discount ticket services and papering services.
Sure, and there's another reason they don't know the prices, because they used to have them in the ABCs and the Times, and they don't have them anymore. But really, there was a time, believe me, when every price was listed, Wednesdays through Saturdays, all the way down the line, you know, I mean, that was part of the ad. And now they keep that from you, because they don't still stop reading.
Excuse my ignorance, have they literally stopped the ABCs?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that they've stopped listing the prices.
Oh, prices.
Yeah, when's the last time any of us bought a print copy of the New York Times, though? I mean, well, I don't know if they have the ABCs, but does anybody really seriously ever go to the print version of the Times to look for the ABCs?
I guess they still do. But as Peter said, if the prices aren't in there, then what's the point of having this little tiny ad with, you know, the theater name and the show title?
Well, at least you know it's playing. And of course, they added logos as time went on too, to make it a little splashy. But still, it was funny. I remember when Curtains came out, and Curtains was a show set in 1959. So they had this display ad of pretending that shows were it was 1959 and Curtains was playing, so they had an ABC ad and they had all these cute things riffing on it, but they didn't have the prices, which they did 1959. Those they omitted, you know, because they didn't want to remind people the prices were in 1959, which I think you could get $8.20 was pretty much the norm then, I think.
On one hand, you don't want to scare the consumers away, and on the other hand, you don't want to low value your product. So if somebody sees that they can get a $39.50 ticket in the ABCs and they go to the box office and it's $79.50 or $120.50 or something like that, then it leads to problems, which comes back to the marketing of the show that we didn't get. You know, they haven't gotten the message out that if you wanted to come see show X, you know, you can get a ticket for $39.50 or $79.50 or something like that. But it seems that this is a problem, and that again, I can't even imagine what goes through Jason Robert Brown's head.
I know, it's really sad. And everyone thought this was going to be the hit.
Yeah, and I'm sure that was one of the reasons he worked on it. I want a commercial success, and this seems to be commercial.
I mean, Honeymoon in Vegas has been kicking around for many, many years.
But it does sound more commercial than any of his other shows.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and so I can understand why he'd be attracted to it. And certainly he did his job. We're not faulting him. I feel everybody did his job. Everybody, yes. I think, made Honeymoon in Vegas the best show it could possibly be. And so I'm blaming more the prices than theater location or anything else. And they didn't even have that much competition. You know, I mean, now, of course, they do, but which is why they're leaving. But there wasn't that much competition in terms of
We did have a brutal winter.
Yes. Yeah, that's fair. We had that's fair.
But so did Wicked.
The problem with Wicked is that Wicked doesn't shovel snow; they shovel cash. You know, it's all this cash.
They have that arcade.
Yeah. in the box office. It's like, I can't get out of the box office. Too much cash. You know, it's a big problem. You know, they're keeping the armored Brinks trucks in business, you know. David Stone. Well, you know?
For the record, Wicked isn't selling out anymore. And, of course, who could expect it to after all these years? But we should point out to our readers that getting tickets to Wicked now is easier than it was in the past. I guess you don't need me to tell you that. But hasn't shown up at TKTS yet. I think it's going to be a while before that happens. But still, there are empty seats at Wicked now.
One more thing about the ABC listings. A friend of Peter's and mine, Kevin McInerney, always stresses.
He's my friend too.
Okay, good.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Lovely guy.
Kevin's great.
I apologize. He always stressed, and maybe it's a little less true now, that how the importance of where of the title of a show in terms of where it falls in the ABC listings, whether it be in the Times or New York Magazine or whoever still does it. New York Magazine does not still do it. I know that. But and so he really felt that if something, you know, started with an A or a B, that it might get more ticket sales than something that started with an X or a Z, because people read from top to bottom, and the first thing that they come to that they find interesting, they're like, oh, you know, maybe I'll see that. So this is germane to, remember when we were discussing Beautiful, and I was like, why didn't they call it You've Got a Friend?
Yeah, Carol King. Last. Yeah.
That's probably why.
The famous story about Michael Bennett saying the show is not going to be called Chorus Line, it's going to be called A Chorus Line, simply so we can get right up there in the ABCs. Yeah, and I do think there is something to be said for that. Kevin also urged that we're better off with ads in the show pictures, photographs rather than logos. He thinks that that sells better too, and I think he may be right about that as well. So one other thing, though, in terms of what we're talking about, you know, you mentioned New York Magazine doesn't list as thoroughly as it once did. There was a time, seriously, in the early 60s, and I'm sure before, but when the New Yorker would not list a show in its listings when it was in previews. It didn't exist. You know, and the funny thing is that Hotspot was a show that I think did something like 43 previews. And for all that period of time, for those 5 weeks, it was not listed in the New Yorker. It didn't exist. Once they opened, then they put it in their listings. But previews did not exist, which is a very strange thing.
Well, I don't know if I shared this with you guys or I absolutely didn't share it with the listeners, but I've been working on a few different new websites. One of them is called What's Playing on Broadway, and basically it's the ABCs in a digital form.
Mm-hmm.
And so What's Playing on Broadway, if you go to whatsplayingonbroadway.com, it's not. You know, really live and working and functional. We're just kicking it around right now and playing with it. But that's conceptually what you're talking about. The other thing that I wanted to mention before we moved on is that I mentioned Ken Davenport before, and Ken has been mentioning for years about eBay-type pricing of Broadway shows and trying to figure out how to make that work from a business perspective, and maybe that will come around. Also, there's a thing called Broadway Roulette. I don't know if you've ever heard about Broadway Roulette. No? Michael, have you ever heard about
it? I don't think so.
Broadway Roulette is a thing where you join it and you give them X amount of dollars, and they basically spin a virtual wheel and give you tickets to whatever comes up. and that's one way to go see a show. And then there's also somebody's been working on a type of overarching Broadway club that where you join this club and you get tickets to, you know, instead of buying a subscription to Roundabout, you buy a subscription to Broadway, and they will give you you join this club and you get tickets to all sorts of things. And so people are trying to make the financial aspect of it work, because certainly producers and business owners that run, you know, a Broadway show is more or less a business, a small business. It really needs to, if you can predict your revenue, it's much nicer to predict a certain, you know, whether it be 10 or 15% of your revenue, you can take a little, what they call a haircut, and instead of selling a $100 ticket, sell an $80 ticket if you guarantee that you're going to sell 10% of your seats at $80 instead of $100 or whatever.
Well, and the Met Opera has made already made some major changes and is making more in its policy. They're advertising now that you can get a subscription for 6 operas, 9 operas, whatever, and then exchange. I think they're saying exchange any one at the time of purchase, which you never used to be able to do. You were locked into it. So they too recognize the value of getting the money up front, because it just makes things better for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Yankees started doing that a number of years ago, that I used to have season tickets to the Yankees, and they're just extraordinarily, extraordinarily expensive. And so I started doing these smaller packages to the Yankees, and you're able to purchase, a series of 15 games or 20 games instead of buying 80 games or so, and exchanging things in and out. It's about customer service, and Broadway has come very far in customer service.
It has,
as well.
It has. And really, I remember Robert Burstein, the critic, writing once that most of the people writing into the New York Times in the theater section were not writing about the quality of the shows, but about the snippy box office managers and how terrible they were when they went to get tickets. That has really disappeared. Let's give a shout out to the people who work in box offices.
Yeah.
I think they're very, very nice, and that has totally changed from the imperious attitude they used to have once upon a time. So good for all of them, and who's ever been training them in customer service. And I imagine there are at least 3 different companies that have 3 different people or organizations doing it. Congratulations to you all. You're really doing good work.
Well, I have several friends who work in box offices. So here.
Yes, absolutely. So Michael got a chance to see Broadway by the year from 1941 to 1965. Michael, were those ticket prices $8 and $10 as well?
No, but this remains one of the best bargains in the city. You can go see a whole clutch of Broadway and other really talented performers for a fraction of what you would pay on Broadway. And they do, if you like really great older songs, although they run the gamut from year to year. Broadway by the Year, produced and hosted by Scott Siegel and created by Scott Siegel, they often focus on a particular year, like the Broadway musicals of 1948 or the Broadway musicals of 1972. But this one, they hadn't done one in a while. I think they're doing fewer of them, and I think that's a good thing, because I think to some extent maybe it was a little it was a little bit of overkill, and their audience was responding to that. But this one, I'm happy to say, was packed. I sat upstairs and I looked back, and even the furthest reaches of the mezz or the balcony or whatever you call it at Town Hall were full. This was the Broadway musicals of 1941 to 1965. So we had really quite a list. I'll just mention some of the highlights. Liz Callaway sang Look to the Rainbow. Ryan Silverman and Alexandra Silber did Tonight from West Side Story, and they did that unplugged. That is one of the features of these shows at the Town Hall. Usually they do sometimes they do entire shows unplugged, no amplification. But even the regular shows, they use usually one or two people who do it. And it's always so special to hear that in an acoustically viable space, because we just so few opportunities to hear that anymore anywhere. Let's see, Ben Davis and Julia Murney did There Once Was a Man from Pajama Game, and you can maybe help me with this one, Peter. Scott Siegel came right out and said that the song was written by Frank Lesser. Is that your opinion?
It has less to do with my opinion, but
your understanding?
I became reasonably friendly with Richard Adler towards the end of his life, and he would never concede an inch on anything like that. But when I interviewed John Raitt, out of the blue, he brought up that that was absolutely true. I didn't even ask him. I'm telling you, you know, and he said, and Dick Averill kill me for saying this, but so I guess it's true. I remember Sylvia Hersher, who used to work with Julie Stein, saying it's nice when everybody helps. And I think that's the way we have to look at it, you know. So it's also been said that he wrote A New Town is a Blue Town, which really does sound like Frank Lesser. I mean, that does sound like a second cousin to My Time of Day from Guys and Dolls. Mm. So but anyway, that's very interesting that he came out and said that so baldly.
Yeah, I don't know what to think, because I had also heard there A New Town is a Blue Town. I don't think I had heard that once was a man. And then, John Raitt, you can't get a much better source than that. But I recall that discussion of Frank Lesser writing
My White Knight.
Yes, and Barbara Cook was singing somewhere, and I got to speak with her afterwards, and it came up somehow, and she very adamantly said Frank Lesser didn't write a note of that score.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, she may be not know. She may be not telling the truth to protect the memory of Meredith Willson, but I can't not accept.
But I will say this, of the thousands upon thousands upon thousands, and I mean that literally, of interviews I have done with people, the people with the best memories have been Larry Grossman, somebody we'll have on in a couple of weeks, Karen Morrow, and John Raitt. Those are the three who impressed me most with memory. So it's not as if he was futzing around saying, what's the name of that guy? You know who I mean. You don't. Right. Come on. The one with the hair. You know, nothing like that. I mean, he had the facts and figures memorized in his head over so many of his shows. I mean, even Carnival and Flanders. I mean, he talked about in great detail. So I believe him.
Yeah, he had. I had the pleasure once too.
Did you? Oh, okay. Then you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And at his home in California. Uh-huh. It was incredible.
Uh-huh.
Go back to Broadway by the Year. Jeff McCarthy sang Once Upon a Time, which and he even made a little remark when he came out, something like, here I am in visiting ballad world, because he's not necessarily known as a, you know, a ballad singer or a romantic leading man type. But he did a beautiful job with it. I kind of forgot what a gorgeous voice he has. And of course, that's one of the most beautiful songs ever written, Once Upon a Time. So that was a real, real treat. But it was all over the place. Steve Rosen sang I'm Don Jose from Far Rockaway from Wish You Were Here. When are you going to hear that?
Frankly, I would much rather hear songs like that than Tonight and Once Upon a Time, which Scott knows his audience. He knows what he's doing and what it is. I will admit that more people are interested in hearing performers do songs just to see how the performers will interpret them than I do. I'm much more interested in the song itself. And I guess, you know, what else was there in 1952 that he might have been able to take? But you know, there are other Wish You Were Here songs I might go to before I'd go to Don Jose. But still, I'd like a night of, like, true obscurities and see how that would play out. But that's
yeah. Cool. No, definitely. But they do try to mix to a certain extent. I mean, of course, as you said, they want to give the people what they want. But that was the real obscurity in this concert. Mm-hmm. And then we had Noah Racey doing It's All Right With Me with a tap dance. He can always be counted on to dance. So that was great. Leroy Reams did a Hello Dolly medley, which I think he's been doing around in various concerts. Larry White, who I love, did You'll Never Walk Alone with a Chorus. And one of the other absolute highlights was that Molly Pope did Too Darn Hot. And it was really choreographed, and I'm not that familiar with her. She's got a great, voice. And in this case, she was singing way in her alto, low in her alto range. That's a pretty low song. And again, unplugged, and she filled the entire theater. People went nuts for her, because I think she's not as well known as some of these others. Sure, and they're like, who is this woman? You know, we want to see her again, and I'm sure that they will.
So, did you talk about the Scott Siegel connection to this? all the work that he does?
Yeah, I mentioned.
You did?
He's a host and creator and I could producer. What is his actual credit here?
All Let me also stuff. Say, when he started, a lot of people were naysayers saying, oh, nobody's going to go to that.
Absolutely.
Really, he has proved them wrong.
And this isn't the only series. Doesn't he do the Unplugged series as well? I know that you mentioned that some of this concert was Unplugged, but doesn't he have a whole freestanding Unplugged series?
Yes, I did. I mentioned that also. Okay. That's the same. And his credit, by the way, is creator, writer, host. I should also mention almost always the musical director, arranger, pianist is Ross Patterson. With his Little Big Band, which is basically drums and bass. But they just do really, really yeoman work. I'm glad that I hadn't been to one in quite some time, and I'm happy that this was such a good one.
Scott's a very genial host too, and he comes up with nuggets of information that are really charming. So he does a good job there too.
Yeah, like the thing about There Once Was a Man being written by Frank Lesser.
Well, I don't know if that's charming, but anyway.
All right, so I know this is the third or maybe even the fourth week in a row that we've talked about this, but I got a chance to see the Heidi Chronicles, and I just wanted to weigh in very briefly about that I loved it.
Oh, good.
I really did, and I didn't think it was long, and I'm thinking, I thought about this after the fact, and maybe it was that I was prepared, because you know, the press reps, you know, emailed me a number of times and said, 2:30, it's going to be 2 hours and 30 minutes. And then, in Michael's review of it, Michael said he felt it was really long. And Peter said, oh, it's a little bit long. And so I maybe mentally went into it, but I really had a great time. I thought it was really good. I didn't really mind all the cultural references that Michael took issue with. I really thought it helped me place it and remind me where it was in the timeline relate to, the issues that were at hand at the day.
The context.
Yeah. I had no issue with Elizabeth Moss's voice. And we were very close. So I don't know if it was an amplification thing. So because I was really hearing her and not any body mic. Mm-hmm. And Jason Biggs and Bryce Pinkham, just wow. I thought that I think that this is a really, really solid production, and I encourage people to go see it. I had a great time at it.
As far as the length, I really think that more specifically, I was surprised, and I had forgotten how much longer the second act is as compared to the first. Because that's pretty unusual. So I forgot, I saw the show originally, but I was like, well, oh, I'm trying to think what happens next and where does this come? And I just didn't remember that the break was relatively so soon in the the arc of the play. But whatever.
So, yeah. So those are the three of us, actually the four of us, because Carrie weighed in on it as well a few weeks ago. You can see opinions all across the spectrum there from four different folks who see a lot of Broadway theater. So let's move forward into some other news type of items. I read this morning on Facebook, and certainly this is not an official announcement from the production, but I read this morning on Facebook that Hunchback is definitely not transferring to Broadway. And so I wanted to mention that because Peter and Michael's review of it, as well as Carrie's review of it, we talked about, again, how this has had a multi-year life for the German production that we talked about a number of weeks ago, all the way through the production of the Paper Mill Playhouse, which closes today at the Paper Mill Playhouse, Sunday, April 5th. So it doesn't look like it's going to be transferring. Peter, Michael, do you think it's going to maybe go out on the road?
What I'm hoping is that they're going to redesign the set and that's what I'm hoping this pause in its history is going to be, because there's a good deal of worth in the show itself, and that's what needs to happen. That set really makes the show far more boring than it deserves to be.
Yeah, I really like much of the score, but I just don't. I'm not sure, and I always hate to use this phrase because it's so hackneyed, who the audience is for it, because it's certainly too adult and too heavy for children. And for adults, I just think it's maybe conversely too melodramatic and cartoonish in a way. So I don't know. Who they think they're going to market it to and where.
This may sound like the strangest thing I've ever said, but I wonder how much they're hurt by the fact that their source material comes from the same guy who wrote Les Mis. And, you know, I just wonder if they'd have an easier time of it if Guy de Maupassant had written The Hunchback of Notre Dame. I agree. It's a very strange perception. But and I don't know how much the public would care or even notice that, oh, this is by the same guy who wrote Les Mis, therefore, you know, I have to judge it in those terms. I don't know, but somehow it did occur to me while I was watching it that this is Victor Hugo, and I like the other musical better.
And there's obviously the talk is that there's not as much audience for that type of musical anymore anyway. Obviously the revival of Les Mis is doing very well, but that's a revival. So I don't know what new show of that type have we had that has been a hit.
Right.
And it's been a really long time.
Yeah, in a strange way, Les Mis' grandfather clause'd in, you know. So I certainly see your point that a lot of people feel that type of heavy mega musical has come and gone.
Yeah.
So.
All right. And we don't very often get into any political stuff on this broadcast, but I did want to mention that Audra McDonald took to Twitter to criticize the Indiana law over the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Indiana. And did you guys hear much blowback about this week, or did you hear about what Audra had done?
Sure, sure. And it's wonderful how many people are coming to be critical of what's gone on there. As my friend Barry Bierns said, when I saw that NASCAR was saying we're not going to have anything to do with Indiana or was considering it, she said, I really thought I was reading The Onion. Because, I mean, you know, who would expect NASCAR,
Walmart,
you know, that butch organization, you know, to say something like this? I put something on Facebook that is going to be in my column on Critzeland on Friday. But years ago, there was a wonderful song in When Pigs Fly. This is 1996, almost 20 years ago. Mm. It was the first act finale, and it was called a patriotic finale because they didn't want to give away the gist of the song. But Mark Waltrip and Dick Gallagher, God rest his soul, wrote a phenomenal song, which started You Can't Take the Color Out of Colorado. You Can't Take the Mary Out of Maryland. And it went all like that. You know, you can't take the sissy out of Mississippi. And the point is, you need us to make the USA. And that's a very clever line, too, because you do need the UNS to make the USA. You know, so it was very clever. But here's the interesting thing. At the end of the song, the point is made, think of Provincetown, Key West, and San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Without us, they'd be a lot more like Fort Wayne. Fort Wayne's in Indiana. And, of course, Mark Waldrop had no idea that Indiana was going to take this stance, you know, 19 years later. But it's just one of those fortuitous things that happened. But it did start me thinking about that and what a wonderful song that is. But, you know, and I love the governor trying to explain that this isn't what it is. You know, that's a lot of fun. And I don't know if we're going to see him throw his hat in the ring for 2016. And I get he thought he was going to be able to as a result of this. But I love the statement yesterday. I found out, too, that in a poll taken, that people have a worse opinion of evangelical Christians than they do of gays. That was an interesting study, and I won't be surprised if that continues as time goes on, because the gays are just trying to live their lives. The evangelical Christians are the ones who are trying to change things. Leave it alone.
Yeah, the backtracking was quite hilarious.
Hilarious.
Indiana and Arkansas, right? They rewrote. Well, that's not what we meant.
That's not what we meant. Oh, did Governor Pence have flop sweat? I mean, it was amazing.
He did. He literally had flop sweat.
Yeah. It was great, you know. So give up, guys. You're not going to win this fight. There's no reason why you should. It's over. You know, I mean, really, what do you think the gays are going to say? Okay, we're going to retreat. We're going to become what we were. We're going to be closeted again. We're not going to tell us what we really believe, what we feel, what we think. We don't have the right to do that. That's not going to happen. Stop it.
I'm sorry about that sneeze. I thought it was muted, but I didn't make it.
Oh, that's okay. So you guys have it on your calendar to see Skylight?
Sure.
Yep.
You know, it's all the rage. Everybody's talking about it. When do you see it?
I think Wednesday.
I have it on Wednesday, and then Friday I have, which I had not seen previously and really intrigued about, is Hand to God.
Yeah.
I've seen Hand to God twice. I saw it off-Broadway and off-Broadway, and I'm going again on Saturday. Boy, that's Stephen Boyer. Oh, what a performance. Mm-hmm. Talk about evangelical Christians. That's what this is all about, and certainly dealing with a lot of repression that goes on with such people. So Mark Hudish has a wonderful line that starts with the word God. I won't say anything else, but it's a wonderful line.
By the way, coming up this weekend next is something that a lot of people might not know about. Something, again, very reasonable ticket prices. The musical's Tonight production of Pardon My English. So that'll be starting on Tuesday.
And in fact, on Friday, I'll be doing a talk back after the show, after the Friday matinee at 2 o'clock. So I'll be there. So,
oh, great.
Yeah.
So Friday I have Hand to God, and Saturday I have my full day long Wolf Hall.
That's for me.
Mine is not Sunday. So
is there still no signage over the Winter Garden for this? I mean, is it still gray, that wonderful sign, the most famous sign on Broadway? How come that's not painted? How come they're not? Do they really feel they're not going to be there that long? It's not going to be worth it? I mean, that's really sad when the Winter Garden sign is dark.
Yeah.
Good God. Is it still? It may have changed. I mean, I haven't been by in a few days. Maybe there's stuff up there now. I hope there is.
You mean the big huge sign over the
yeah
not the marquee. You mean the
no
right,
the famous sign.
Yeah. No, I think it's still the way it was. I was there yesterday, the day before. And so Wolf Hall is also playing on PBS with Mark Rylance in a 6-part series of the television take on this. So if you do not get the chance to get to New York to see it, check it out on PBS. The other things to talk about is that speaking of the Winter Garden and things like that, is it really true that there's going to be a revival of Cats?
Yeah. I'm sure it'll do well. Cats was really hated for running so long. Ken Mandelbaum once said, you know, if it ran 2 years and disappeared, people would have been crying for a revival. And now enough time has passed. I mean, you know, really, it'll be 15 years, won't it? I think so. You know, and that's a considerable amount of time. And, you know, I remember Clacy Miller, a very talented actress who I knew from Cincinnati Conservatory of Music. I said, how'd you get interested in theater? She said, well, I saw Cats. And she was so embarrassed by it, you know. And she put her hand over mine and said, look, I was young, you know, I was just starting, you know, all that, a million excuses. Enjoy yourself. I mean, really. I mean, if that's what gets you interested in theater, fabulous. Maybe a lot of kids will be interested in theater. It's just the longevity that really angered a lot of people.
there's no truth to the rumor that Al Pacino's coming back in Cats, because he will be coming back in China Doll.
That's something.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. You know, a new David Mamet play? I'm interested.
And Tommy Tune is going to get a Tony Award. Does this make it an odd number or an even number for him?
Even number. Tommy Tune 10. That's another one of your tongue twisters. Tommy Tune has 10 Tonys. But he does. This will be his 10th. You know, so that's pretty impressive. Frankly, I would have rather he had got an honorary Tony the year that he did another show, apparently
the timing is a little odd. I have to say,
Michael Dale posted on Facebook after the announcement of the honorary Tony that he's very excited that he'll be able to watch Tommy Tune's honorary Tony on Broadway World because it'll probably happen during a commercial. On the Tony Award broadcast, and they won't show it. So we'll see if that comes to fruition.
Not impossible. Unlikely, I'll admit, but not impossible.
No, I think that they – but I'm thinking they'll build a production number around it.
So that kind of wraps it up for today. So I want to remind listeners that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us on iTunes. You can listen to us on Stitcher, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, Android device. And it will be streamed to you. Broadway World Radio plays this Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. Peter, do you have an answer to the trivia question from last week?
Yes, indeed. The question was, who was the first person to get a Tony nomination for a role that he didn't originate in rehearsal or out of town, that he took over somewhere along the line before they actually got to New York? And the answer is Larry Blyden, who took over for Larry Storch when Flower Drum Song happened. So he was the first one to get a Tony nomination, and that was in the 1958-59 season. Interestingly enough, of course, is the fact that they're both of them were named Larry, and of course that neither one of them was Asian, and of course that would never happen today, but back then it did, and so that's what happened there. So,
was John Cullum nominated for On a Clear Day?
I don't remember. I hope so,
because I guess that. Well, I mean, I guess that fits your criteria. Because,
it does fit the criteria if
he was nominated.
but of course, that was 6 years later. So,
Okay, Peter, why don't you give us a trivia question for this week?
Okay. In the LP era, occasionally there were shows that had two records and not just one, like She Loves Me, because there was so much music that they had to go to two discs. What was the first original cast album to have two discs and not just one?
All right. So if you do know that question, the answer to that question, drop us a line. All of our contact information is at BroadwayRadio.com. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.